Hello, and welcome to the Sorry Most podcast. I'm your host, Reese, and in this episode, I'm joined by Mike as we journey back in time for the history of Disney animated films. Now, before we start, I'd just like to mention that if you'd like to interact with us on the podcast, then you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Reddit if you search the name. Check out our community podcast. That's cool. Like, subscribe, do whatever. Come and see us.
Come and see us.
Come and see us. And, yeah, thank you, Spike Kappa, for the theme music, as ever. Now, Disney is obviously a household name in the 21st century, holding a near monopoly over the entertainment industry. It's hard to watch a new release in cinema that isn't owned or produced by the big mouse. Intrigued by how they became this successful, I decided to watch all 58 animated films, now up to 59, I think, since starting this, a genre which Disney are most well known for. Having noticed Mike has started making his way through the films too, I couldn't miss this opportunity to ask him about the films. Today, we'll be covering the last of the Silver Age, the first four we covered in the previous episode. Most notable for being the last films Walt Disney worked on before his death. A bit of a purple patch for Disney, all four films discussed today were financial hits and are still beloved classics today. Well, for the most part. Because there's one quite bad film in this. So, it took Disney 4 years to follow up Lady and the Tramp with 1959 Sleeping Beauty, adapted from Charles Perrault and Brother Grimm's story and featuring several numbers from Tchaikovsky's ballet. It's the final film to feature one of the big three princesses. It's mainly known for the iconic song Once Upon a Dream and obviously the fantastic villain that is Maleficent. So, Mike, I think you were surprised how much you liked this film, because I remember being very surprised as well. What did you think of Sleeping Beauty?
What surprised how much I liked it. I always thought it sounded like a pretty boring concept. So I think what you know about Sleeping Beauty before you've seen it is, oh, this princess is cursed, she falls asleep, and then she gets woken up by true love's kiss.
Yeah.
But no, I thought it was way more than that. It was really cool. I think, as you already said, Maleficent's a fantastic villain, and I can see why she became so popular. And this made me want to go and check out her films, which I haven't seen. Yeah, I thought she was fantastic. I thought it was a more sort of action-packed and exciting and fast film than I expected for a film called Sleeping Beauty. You've already pointed out the music was great. I think the middle act does drag a bit, but the opening and the ending were just a lot of fun. It was just a very lively, fun film, but also very dark. And I think that's something some of these films did very well, was feeling dark while still being quite fun. So yeah, I was surprised by it. It really impressed me.
Yeah, the thing is, though, this is the third of the big three princesses. I mean, you think of Disney on any cover, these are the three for back then, Aurora, Cinderella, and Snow White. And I didn't think the first two of these were that great. Like, Snow White had its moments, don't get me wrong, but Cinderella was really disappointing. And again, Sleeping Beauty is just the world's most boring title. And you just think, this is going to be the lamest thing you ever watch. It's going to be like a princess lovey-dovey fest. But it really isn't, because the moment that turned it for me was the fairies. Flora, Fauna, and Merriweather, I thought they were hilarious. And there were bits in this where I hadn't seen, as lots of these old films, I hadn't seen for 15, 20 years. And still I remember bits of them, and it all floods back to you. Particularly the bit where they're baking the cake and they're making the dresses, bits where they're cutting around and Merriweather gets wrapped up and folding the eggs, the full eggs into the batter, like stuff like that. I remember that from being a kid. The main one is in the final battle as well, is the thorns coming up. I have a distinct memory of that's an iconic scene in any film. The fight between Prince Philip and Maleficent, one of the most iconic moments of animation ever. But no, the bickering fairies and the troublesome fairies, and oh, isn't it such a shame we're so nice, because I'd love to kill Maleficent if I could. I found that quite funny.
I thought the prince, is it Prince Philip?
Philip. Oh.
Right, okay, Prince Philip.
Not that one.
I thought he was a better character deeper than I expected. Because usually your charming prince in these films is just the exact same template over and over. But I thought he was really good. He was very charming. It was like, it was very clear what his motivations were for the whole thing. Yeah. And when I went into a film called Sleeping Beauty, I didn't expect it to end with this like brave knight with a sword and shield fighting a dragon. I thought that was really cool. And I knew that Maleficent turned into a dragon. So obviously that's something that's in just cultural knowledge in general, isn't it? Like you fight her as a dragon in Kingdom Hearts when she's the boss of the first game. Her daughter turns into a dragon in Descendants 2 to bring up that franchise. And it's, I think what struck me a lot while watching this is that out of all of these Disney films, this seemed to be the one that most inspired Shrek, I think. Because it's got the storybook, the opening. He's got to go off to the dungeon to wake up the girl, the true love's kiss. He's got to fight the dragon while he's there. That's what I was like. It's very clear that this is the one that like Shrek based its first half off, and I love Shrek. So
yeah, I also thought this is it felt like a very rich film. A lot happened in it. Like you got the start even before Aurora's born, and she gets cursed. And you're already there. The tension is that Maleficent is cursed her to death, and already the fairies have saved her to only go to sleep forever, which is basically death until true love's whatever. So there's quite like good stakes to it. Again, you get to the fight at the end. It's just a really good looking film as well.
It's gorgeous.
I think particularly when they start dancing in Once Upon a Dream, there's some great bits when they're dancing and the reflection comes up, and particularly, and it's quite disappointing the later films are going to watch out, which I do think look a little bit cheaper. This one definitely doesn't, because they had a lot of time to do this film. They have four years. Yeah,
it really shows that they like put the time in.
And you know, this is meant to be the right. We don't have to get. We've had our big hit, our four hits after the war. We're making money now. Let's make a big hit that will make a lot of money, which happened. I also like Prince Philip. I just like the fact that the one scene they're like, oh yes, she's going to be betrothed to this prince. Next scene we see a prince and it's like, I wonder who that is. And the fact that they meet up, they don't know who they are, and then they it's not like they're forced to be in love because one's a prince and one's a princess. They get to know each other first, and then Philip makes the decision to save her.
Which is something that Cinderella, I think, tried to do. They didn't know who each other were. They got to know each other first. But this, I just think, does it better. I think it's a much stronger version of the same thing.
Mm.
And I think that as well, at this point in media, true love's kiss is just the most boring cliche ever. But watching this, it feels all right because obviously it's so old. This film, that it wasn't a cliche yet, and you can feel that when watching it, that like it actually works in this film and it hasn't become very lame yet.
So I've just been thinking about your Shrek comparison. It has occurred to me that when the mirror is announcing the potential brides, it's Cinderella, Snow White and Fiona. So even then it's like she's the replacement for Aurora then. No, Maleficent is, I like the first film. I think it takes the villain, and because I don't think Maleficent is like inherently evil at the start. We're told she is by the good fairies, but it's one of those you're like, yeah, but I'm sure everyone treats her like shit, so she's probably all right to not like anyone, and she's a powerful person. But no, Maleficent gives her a lot of depth, and I think Angelina Jolie replicates what Eleanor Audley does in this film perfectly. I definitely recommend seeing the first one. The second one is garbage because it undoes everything in the first film. But
you can tell watching this film that Angelina Jolie is like the perfect casting as well.
Yeah.
Sleeping Beauty gets a lot of play in Kingdom Hearts as well for such a small film. So as I said, Maleficent's the sort of main bad guy of the first one. And she shows up in a lot of the others as well. She keeps popping up. There's obviously there's a level based around Kingdom, around Sleeping Beauty, which is exploring her castle and the Enchanted Land and sort of fighting in the castle. So yeah, it's a film that gets a lot of play throughout those games.
I have noticed, you can go back to it, but we've been talking about Sleeping Beauty. We haven't actually spoken about the Sleeping Beauty. I've noticed, I don't want to go away and not even mention about the main character of the film. Do you have any thoughts on her, perhaps compared to Snow White, Cinderella?
I always thought she would be very bland, because I assume she would spend most of the film asleep, which she sort of does. I think that Snow White and Cinderella were probably the stronger parts of their own films, but I wonder if that's just because their films were quite weak overall, whereas I think that Aurora's not the highlight of her own movie, because obviously you've got Maleficent and the fairies and all of that, but she's not a bad character. I think in the first half, you really sort of feel for her. So obviously she gets an amazing song. You get the sense that she doesn't know why she's living the life she is. But obviously, you know, there's a good reason for it. So they do a really good job of making you feel for her. But I think that as a character, she doesn't quite shine as strongly as maybe some of the other princesses.
Mm. Is she in Kingdom Hearts?
She's asleep.
Oh, no, she's asleep, of course. That's the plot of the film. What, do you just fight the dragon? Or does she come up quite a bit?
Well, one of the sort of things in, if I'm remembering correctly, in the first Kingdom Hearts is that Maleficent is trying to go around to kidnap all the princesses so she can use their like spirits to unlock something. So she comes up in the first game. Then after that, she's sort of just a side character that occasionally shows up like the others. And in her own level, if I remember rightly, she's asleep the whole time. So you can't wake her up.
There's
not a mechanic in the game.
There's no button for kiss.
Nope.
I'll leave this one, this line, because it was a line that made me chuckle quite a bit. It looks awful. And then when the dress is on Meriwether, and the other person says, "That's because it's on you, dear," which I thought was
savage.
Pretty savage. There's a lot of those moments in this film where they're just like, the fairies are like, yeah, they're trying to do good, but they're like, oh, I wish I could kill Maleficent. It'd just be so much easier. Yeah.
The fairies are like a more entertaining version of the mice from Cinderella.
Yeah, because they can change size as well.
Yeah.
Oh God, there's bloody mice. Anyway, let's talk about a really good film now. Hopefully it is a really good film, in your opinion. Because we move on to 1961's 101 Dalmatians. Of course, recently been rebooted in a way, or been prequeled with Cruella recently. So following the disappointment return of the last film, Sleeping Beauty didn't make that much money. The studio was once again concerned about its finances, and so there were several money-saving animation techniques employed for this film. The main one being xerography, which is a form of animation style that's been adapted over and over again now, but it was first used as a way to save money. But what came out of these cost-cutting methods was a really soft animation, I'd say this. It's a very softly focused animated film, this, and I think it comes out with one of the best villains of all time. She's got her own film now. Cruella de Vil, mate. Cruella fucking de Vil. She's my favourite type of Disney villain, in that she's not evil for evil's sake. She's not trying to conquer the world or rule a kingdom or get revenge in any way. She's just a really nasty person who just wants to murder a load of dogs, puppies, so she can make a coat. Like, she's just nasty, and the way she looks, the colouring of her face, the way she, her posture with the cigarette, and the car, of course, and her henchmen. They just set up a really perfect villain, and once she opens her mouth, you're like, yeah, oh, she's a really, really nasty piece of business. Stop trying to kill dogs, Anita. Why are you friends with her? I don't get it. Just tell her to go away. So yeah, Cruella de Vil. Great character.
I didn't actually know anything about this going in. I'd never seen it before. I'd never seen the live action movies, the Glenn Close ones. Hadn't seen Cruella. And I'd managed to just completely avoid what the story of this film was. And I assumed it was like this whimsical adventure about a bunch of cute little dogs. And it's not that. It's practically a horror movie, this. Like, it's really like harrowing. I loved this. It's currently my number one of this whole watch through, my favourite film we come across so far, because it was just amazing. Like, it wasn't... I thought I was going in for a fun time. That's not what I got. I think the Dalmatians were great characters, and like the puppies were adorable. I think, as you already said, Cruella was an amazing villain. And what were her henchmen? Is it
Jasper and
Pongo Horace. And Jasper?
No, Pongo's the dog. It's Jasper and Horace.
They were great, and they were like constantly like very threatening. Like, it's easy with psychics like that to make them a bit too wacky. Like Bulk and Skull. I don't know why that's what came to my mind. But yeah, they were constantly like cowering. I think that the whole film, where it's just like the Dalmatians on the run trying to like get back and get away from these people, it was just so tense, and there was a constant like every single moment felt dangerous for these puppies. And I was watching, I was thinking, like, I can't imagine watching this as a kid because it would freak me out. But it means that you occasionally get in this like the short moments of like levity and stuff. And when those like little moments come, because the rest of the film is so like distressing, they're so welcome, and they really make you feel for these dogs. And it means that like every time they're in danger, you're completely stressing out. Every time like they're going through a hard time, you're freaking out about it. And then when they finally have their happy ending, it feels like such a fantastic victory. And I think, is this the one with the like very jazzy soundtrack?
Yes, it is. Which I think goes really well with the animation. Again, I think it's particularly the early scenes within the house. There's a very like underdrawn slash soft like focus to it. There's like, it's as if the backs and sort of like faded into the background. It really works with the music, which is also, well, you know, jazz. It's a very loose throwaway sort of music. You know, you play what you feel basically, and it does really fit well into this. I think. The Cruella de Vil song, which comes out of nowhere in the plot. It's like he's just humming it to himself, and it turns into a full song, sang by Bill Lee. Great, great little song, very jazzy, and it perfectly encapsulates the character even before we meet her. Like, you know what to expect. She's going to turn up. She's the sort of person. Oh, hi Cruella, can you leave now, please? My favourite scene was probably when the dogs are watching the television and they're watching Thunderbolt. So you got the bits where Thunderbolt is chasing the baddie, and then all their tails are wagging. They're going, oh, this is great. He's going to beat him up. And then Thunderbolt gets shot, and they're like, all their tails stop wagging, and they're like, oh God, is he dead? And oh no, this is horrible. And then there's a jump scare, because when Patch goes to the screen and there's a jump scare, they all jump back. And then when he's finally defeating the villain, all the dogs are barking together. I think that's a really nice little moment.
But it's like watching this movie.
Yeah, and then it is. And then like even one of the dogs like swears, and like the Ponga gets told off by the Perdita. Like, he didn't learn that language from me. And there were some. I wasn't that fond of the main two humans. I mean, they're just there as like a vehicle to move the dogs forward, I guess. But they're just standard poshos, which was a bit crap. Go on.
There's even like the moments in this where like you think like, oh yes, what a victory. You can't enjoy because you know it's going to go wrong. Like when they're trekking through the snow, and you think like. And it's like they're having such a hard time of it. And then they reach that barn and you're like, ah, oh, bit of safety. And then they like coat themselves in the soot to look like black Labradors instead of Dalmatians. And the whole time you think like, this is just, it's going to go so wrong. And like, I can already feel it coming. And it's like, just, you can't rest watching it. Like you're constantly on edge.
And also there is a bit, you always get this, and I got this throughout a couple of these films, like waiting for a moment that fit the title. And so you meet the two dogs. There's two Dalmatians at the start. And then they have 15 puppies with each other. 14, then 15, because of the little scare with the thing, the stillborn. That's quite a little sad moment. But then like, it's just like, but hang on, it's not 101 Dalmatians, is it? Like, where are the others? And you reach Cruella's place, and it's like, oh my God, there are so many of them.
So many.
And then they all... They're all in the house at the Christmas at the end, in the Dalmatian plantation. Like, it's 102 Dalmatians is good fun as well, if you ever get the chance to watch that one. I really liked Jasper and Horrocks were, like, as you said, they were good, like, they were good side villains. There were points where I was like, I'm not sure if they're cruel enough to kill 100 dogs. I wasn't convinced at all that they would be able to do that. But yeah, they Cruella seemed to put them in their place constantly. I've written down here, and I don't think this is entirely true. I said that the the final car chase is better than the final car chase in Tokyo Drift, because I can see what's happening.
You can see what's happening, and there's more tension. The characters are built up.
Yeah, and also there's lots of other side characters. You've got the colonel, the dog. You've got the sergeant, the cat who goes in and saves there's a real heroism around, like, all these animals come together to save someone who's abused them. You've got the dog, you've got the Great Dane as well, who comes in, the Welsh bloodhound, the sheepdog. You've got the horse that comes in as well. I mean, the defining frame of this film for me, I remember from years ago, is when Tibbs is stood in front of all the Dalmatians in front of the two henchmen. I think this is really iconic. I'm really surprised you haven't seen it before, just because there are other adaptions of it as well.
No, I just completely avoided it.
The weird thing is, it's very much the formula that you get with these early films, particularly and it's the same with the Aristocats a little bit, and it's the same with what you saw with Lady the Tramp, is that you get introduced to this one character, yeah. And then you learn about their life entirely. And then they just add like 10, 15, 20 other characters all in the final act.
Pile them on.
All in the final act. And then they all run after each other or something. There's always a chase. And it's just like, this hits I think this really perfected the formula of getting those emotional beats in. As well, as you said, as soon as this film slows down, you sit back and go, huh, that's a really nice moment. And, you know, Pongo and the other dog forgot her name already. The Pongo, they're good drivers of this. And again, the puppies are just so cute. I mean, there's 99 of them, like, and they're all very distinct. They've got distinct personalities, which is something that I was really surprised at when I saw that, because I don't really remember the characters as a child. But the last thing to say is that before you get onto Kingdom Hearts, I don't know if there is a Kingdom Hearts. If they leave out Cruella Kingdom Hearts, that'll suck. But this is the last film that involved Clyde Geronimi and Hamilton Lusk, who did a lot of the films that we've already watched. And so not only is this the end of an era for Walt Disney when we get to Jungle Book, there's sort of like a changing of the guard here a little bit as well. But yeah, great film. I'm not surprised it's your top. It's my top of these four films. Yeah, it's just really beautiful.
Very good.
What did you think of the jazz anyway?
I liked it.
Because it's another film where there were no songs, were there? It's incidental music. Which
feels weird in a Disney film to have, like,
yeah,
the music.
Yeah, and the final chase, you said the soot covered dogs, the driving, the way that they're tracking through the snow, and there's a horror bit, like, I remember watching it. They do escape initially the Cruella de Vil's house or wherever it is, and it's like, yeah, but they've got to trek through the snow without. Are they all going to make it? And there's a bit where, like, one's about to fly off the van and he gets caught.
Because the 60s Disney, for all you know, they could just die.
Yeah.
They could all just die.
Yeah.
You mentioned Kingdom Hearts. They don't have a Kingdom Hearts level for 101 Dalmatians, but they are pretty prominent in the first one because they're collectibles. So you when you get to the hub world, like two or three levels in to Kingdom Hearts 1, you meet the two adult puppies. The two adult Dalmatians, and they're like, oh no, we've lost our puppies. Can you find them? And all throughout the world, like, you don't find the puppies just chilling around. Like, just sometimes you'll open a chest and it'll go, you found Dalmatians 91, 92, and 93. Yeah. Then slowly, they like go back to their house out the game. Like, it's just getting more and more full of Dalmatians, like, chilling about. Mm. So, yeah, it's weird. They're in the game, but they're collectibles that you find in chests.
Yeah. What about the, is it like the Riddler trophies? Like, there are 100...
Just around. Well, there's 99 of them.
Yeah, do you have to find them, or is it, like...
No, it's an optional thing. And you get, like, rewards for doing it.
Cool. Yeah, right. Now from a really good film to not a really good film. because the next
arguably a really bad film.
It's barely a film, because the next film to talk about is 1963's The Sword and the Stone, based off The Once and Future King by T.H. White. It tells the tale of Wart, a young boy destined to be the ruler of Britain, and his adventures with the time-travelling Merlin. There's not a lot to say about this, other than glad that this guy wasn't my science teacher, because Merlin is a really, really badly written character. I don't care. I don't care that it's meant to be meta or whatever. Not good. I think this is one of the worst films out there. I don't think there's a single good character in the entire film. The voice acting is iffy. That doesn't help that the main actor for Arthur, like midway through the production, his voice broke, so they had to find a new one. And so it's even like scene to scene, you can like line to line, you can hear that it's a different person saying it. That doesn't help. Also the fact that when, and it's like the same with Sleeping Beauty and the 101 Dalmatians, if you call the film Sword in the Stone, and it's okay with the other ones, they build up to the other ones, but in this, it's literally the last 2 minutes of the film, he lobs it out and then the film is over. Yep. Nothing that came before has anything to do with it. Why is it called Sword in the Stone? Because it's based on the book Sword in the Stone. But still, like, don't leave me in such anticipation. And that's the problem with this film, right? I'm sat there going, where's Excalibur? Do the Sword in the Stone bit. Do the Sword in the Stone bit. I don't care about the horny squirrels. I've had enough of the hawk. The hawk bit is exactly the same to the carp bit at the start. Exactly the same thing. Madame Mim is rubbish, like, as a final boss villain.
Yeah, she's awful.
Yeah, you just turn into bacteria. What? And then you get to the final battle, like, and... Okay, it gets to the final bit where they put the sword back in, he has to prove himself again. Even, like, there's, like, even a moment of fun where they could have had where, like, he puts the hand on the sword, it glows up, and he goes away and it stops glowing. Like, they didn't even play around with that. But at least it isn't like Guy Ritchie's David Beckham. Put 10 fingers around the sword and give it a yank.
I'd rather watch Guy Ritchie's awful King Arthur again than this again. Beckham. Even though it's twice as long as this. I hated this. It's easily my least favourite one so far. And knowing like of most of the other Disney films, I think it's going to be really unlikely that one gets lower than this for me. I hated it. I wanted it to end 10 minutes in, and it just kept going. For a 70-minute film, it feels really long. It's just constant. Like, it's trying to be the wackiest, silliest, funniest adventure with the kookiest scientist. But it's not. Arthur's rubbish, or Newt, or whatever his name is. Merlin's irritating as hell. Like, he's so annoying. Every single, like, set piece is just the worst. It looks boring. The animation's lazy. The music sucks. The story's non-existent. I hated this. I was really like sandwiched in between the two best films of the Silver Age. You have to wonder how this ever happened. It's so bad. And as you said, Madame Mim's boring, and the final fight between them is trash. I hated this.
Yeah, it
was an awful film. I was really disappointed because like if the other Disney films I'd watched through, even the ones that I didn't like love. I hadn't found one I hated yet, and I was hoping there wouldn't be one, because they've all got stuff to like in there. I just don't think this has got anything. I don't think it's got anything redeeming in it at all.
No.
Apart from maybe the last 2 minutes when he pulls a sword out of the stone.
But that should have been the entire
film. It's something
film.
I'm familiar with.
That should have been the entire film.
Yeah. Because King Arthur's not a hard story to get right.
Yeah.
There's a reason hundreds of people have done it.
Yeah, and, you know, if you've ever watched Merlin, it can be done well, even with a low budget. My problem is that you break down the segments as well, even like individual segments. Like we've watched a lot of these anthology films, right? And that's what it felt like. This, just they had some common characters that got into different shenanigans. But at least with the wartime stuff, there was the odd film where you're like, "This is great." Like if I'm gonna go back and watch this film, I'll just watch this little bit. Melody, even like Make My Music has something worth watching. Like you said, Johnny Fedora, if I remember rightly. Like at least that
yeah, it did.
At least that looks good. I can watch that on its own.
And like, it's easy too, because you can just go and find it on YouTube.
Right, the first bit with the carp, when they get turned into fish, that's fun. It's all right. Like, it's not what I came for, but it's a wacky side adventure before we get going, maybe.
It's not help I'm a fish, though, is it?
And it's like the moment they turn into a fish, you go, but there's going to be a bigger fish. As Qui-Gon says, there's always a bigger fish. So where's this carp coming from? And they get saved by the owl. But then you get to the horny squirrels, and it's just like they're learning about jumping, and then this, I presume, some sort of like 9 to 12-year-old gets hit on, and like the and it has the whole thing of the murder. It's like, I'm just gonna let you get out of that one where despite you being squirrels, look what's happening. This is quite horrible to watch. I'm very uncomfortable watching this. It's not funny at all. Go back to the jumping. And then you get to the hawk bit, which is exactly the same segment to the fish bit, except they're flying instead of swimming. We turn into this thing. We're learning how to fly. Oh, there's a bigger bird and it's going to try and eat you.
Yeah, I did think that while I was watching it and they were doing the, like, learning to fly and they're actually learning that. I was sat there thinking, like, did they just, like, copy paste the script?
The script, yeah.
And the same thing again.
Yeah, and then you got Merlin goes to, like, to the future all the time. He's referencing, like, trains and planes and Bermuda and the Hawaiian punch and stuff. He's just like, if I'm a kid...
He's like the genie from Aladdin, but awful.
But not fun, and not Robin Williams.
And not Robin Williams.
Like, and at least those impressions, like, give him a sense of wonder. In this, it just looks like Merlin, why do you keep on going back to the past? Like, you can time travel. Why are you interested in helping Arthur? I don't get it. There's no motivation for you to make him better. Because you're already in the future. The future's fine. Go and pick someone who already knows something about science and teach them instead. What are you doing? Who cares?
But also, he's barely teaching him science.
No.
And not convinced he knows it himself.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. There were two other characters in this. They're completely forgettable. His foster father or whatever, Sir Ector, like, you just bullied him constantly. Like, Merlin, you have magic.
Miserable.
You have magic. Just why don't you turn them into like an animal or something? Like, you're not a very nice person. I've not got much to say about this film. Again, we tried to do this at the Melody Time. Is there any of the segments that stood out to you?
No.
No.
No. The last 2 minutes when he draws a sword, only because it's King Arthur drawing the sword. It's hard to get wrong, but.
Yeah. I don't remember anything about this film.
It's just awful. I didn't. I don't remember much of it, but that's just because I didn't care to. Like, and everything I did remember, I didn't enjoy anyway. No. And it baffles me that this is like some people's like favorite Disney film, because I don't think there's anything in here to enjoy. In fact, like, it's one I would just advise skipping, because you're not going to get anything out of watching it.
And you'll get to this with Robin Hood. I had the same feeling with Robin Hood, because I've seen so many other adaptions of this material. I did go into it with a certain expectation. Like, right, it's got Arthur in it. I know he's a kid, but you can still do all like the pseudo-Arthurian stuff, Merlin training him to be able to pick up the sword. That's what I thought really disappointed me, is that everything that came before the sword pulling had nothing to do with the sword pulling. So
no.
Merlin, the time traveler, all wise person, supposedly, his motivation for teaching this kid shouldn't be because he feels sorry for him. It should be because he realizes, oh my God, this is King Arthur. I found King Arthur as a kid. If I want to make the world a better place, I better like train him and teach him and to be like a just and knowledgeable king. And I thought, like, there's nothing that came before that made you go, yeah, Arthur really deserves to pick that sword up.
This isn't a King Arthur story. This is a bad episode of The Magic School Bus. And I don't enjoy hating films, but sometimes they're just trash.
Also, at this point, is that the rights to these films were picked up like in the 30s, at the same time as Cinderella, Snow White, Alice in Wonderland. You know, there was a long time in the making of this film. Different rewrites, different people coming on board and going off. The fact that it was barely a film in the end, like at least Cinderella and Alice in Wonderland less so. At least, like, there's a... I use this term for Sleeping Beauty. They were quite rich stories. Like, there was a lot going on. They fitted a lot in. And despite how wacky Alice in Wonderland is, there's a weight to all of it because it's quite harrowing, or it's quite... You've got the characters being mean, and you've got... Alice is a poor protagonist who's been through this. But there's, like, it means something. There's iconic characters in it that you remember for a reason. In this... there's none of that. And the fact they had so long to get it right and didn't, in a time where, like, they can take risks and they didn't, it's very disappointing.
Felt like a wartime film.
It did.
But, like, a really bad one.
Yeah. Just because it had recurring characters that popped up once in a while doesn't mean that it wasn't just a series of clip shows. Anyway, let's finish on a positive, because... the next film is fantastic. I mean, we're going to conclude today to look at the final animated film Walt Disney ever produced before his death. I'm pretty sure it's the last film he's involved in before his
that's
death.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's wild.
1966.
It's so early.
Yeah. A certified classic, massively profitable. It made 100 times back its budget. And over the years, DVDs, VHS sales, probably one of the highest selling ones of Disney. I'll have to fact check that, because they're quite a lot that are most higher selling and all that. And it includes some of those iconic songs, villains, scenes in the history of Disney. And I think we get to end on such a wonderful film, The Jungle Book. Mike, I'm going to let you go first, because I love this film.
I really like The Jungle Book. I don't think I liked it as much as you. I think I found the plot and the pacing quite messy, but I think the film was gorgeous. The jungle setting was, like, so well realized. I think it has, up to this point that we've reached, probably the strongest soundtrack so far. I think every song is so good and, like, so catchy and so memorable. And obviously, Bare Necessities is probably one of the top five Disney songs of all time. It's probably on everyone's list of that. I think that the characters, there is not a single forgettable one. Like, I think Mowgli, Baloo, Shere Khan, all of them, they're fantastic. And I think even characters who, like, don't get much exposure, like the little elephant kid.
Oh, man.
Just so adorable.
Stole the show.
So adorable. Yeah, just fantastic. Yeah. Like, I think, as I said, I found the plot and the pacing a bit messy, but I had a hard time caring when the characters and the music were just so fantastic. And yeah, it's The Jungle Book. There's it's as famous as it is for an extremely solid reason, I think. So yeah, and I know you love this one too.
Yeah, I love about 98% of the story. Not a fan of how it ends. In fact, it's one of those things where, as much as I really like this film, I do think that the remake is better. I think the one we get, the Jon Favreau film is really good, because if you've ever seen that film, or even in this film, there's the strong emphasis on the red flower, the fire. It comes in at the end. Well, we see it with King Louis. He wants to learn how to make fire because he's an ape. He's the smartest thing compared to a human out there. But Shere Khan, it's only like a plot point right at the end in this where, oh no, he's scared of fire, so he's going to run away for it. Whereas that is like the main theme of the 2016 film, where, like, the reason why he wants to kill Mowgli is because humans are dangerous, because they have this red flower, this basically nuclear device for animals that can wipe out entire civilizations. And so there's a bit of a justness about Shere Khan. Whereas in this, he just wants to control the jungle. And it's like, no, and he just gets scared off because someone ties fire to his tail, which will probably go out in 2 seconds. So, and then you've got the Beatles vultures just laughing it off. Oh, the Beatles are in this, by the way.
Yeah, the Beatles are in this.
They play the vulture. Very funny. What I really love about this film is that, yes, the Bare Necessities, easily my favourite Disney song. The whole array we're going to get in the future, this is my prime one. I love Phil Harris as Baloo. I think one of my favourite characters of all time as well. If you do our top hundreds, I'll go into Baloo. He's just a really... He's just a character that transcends the setting he's in. You forget he's a bear, for one. You've got all these different characters. You've got Bagheera and Shere Khan and the monkeys. They all feel like very animalistic, whereas Baloo doesn't feel like a bear. His interactions with Mowgli, great. Visually when they're dancing. And he's got a great voice, obviously. And he's like a real moral compass of... He's the one who lets Mowgli go. He grows to love Mowgli in a very short amount of time because he's not in the first act at all. They stumble into him. And within 2 seconds, they're best friends. And you're like, yeah, I believe that. And then he goes and saves Mowgli. And then he has to say goodbye to Mowgli. It's a very quick, like, high, low. And then he feels good for him. This is such a character-driven... And, like, it's like when we said back to... Sword and Stone, Alice in Wonderland. This also does feel like a series of set pieces. However, these series of set pieces are so stacked with iconic characters. I mean, the one that comes straight to mind is Car, the bit with the snake. You got Sterling Holloway as Car, look into my eyes and see.
Shows up a lot now, doesn't he?
Yeah. And then
she's in loads of these.
Yeah. And then Car comes back all the way at the end when, like, Mowgli's down. It's like the first time he stands up to Mowgli, and this time Mowgli can't do anything because he's so deflated. It really shows, like, his vulnerability. And then, like, Shere Khan, like, threatens him. And so even, like, a small character like Car keeps on coming back up and up and is iconic, despite having only a few scenes. And Bagheera is another one like that. Like, the reserve, like, oh, worrying parent. That's quite cool. And, of course, Mowgli, who's just a big ball of joy, and it's,
yeah,
like,
he's fantastic.
It's like man cub. Yeah, he's not a human, he's a man cub. Like, you can see it, the way he walks, the way he talks, the way he jumps. He has no idea of what it means to be a human. Like, he's a pure of heart and loves the stuff around him. And then when he interacts with that baby elephant, as you already said, I mean, we just saw a film full of 99 puppies, not as cute as this elephant. You've got to march the other way, turn around
for the military air. I think Shere Khan, although, like, I think you could set him up and build up to his introduction better, because they mention him a few times throughout, but I think, like, if you'd had him as more of, like, a constantly, like, being built throughout the film, I think it would have made his entrance more impactful. But when he shows up, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, because he rocks up and you're like, ah, so Mowgli's going to die now then.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's terrifying.
Although they team up in the end, don't they? Which is sort of thing. Like, they group up and they defeat him together. But then the ending, and I've saved saying this, he just gets hypnotized by this girl and you're just like, I just felt lazy. Just felt lazy. Like, we didn't even get a big. We didn't get a big emotional goodbye because he's too transfixed by this girl taking water or something, and it's just like, say goodbye. I want the closure.
It feels weird to think that there were humans this close to this story. So obviously that has to be for Mowgli to have ended up there, but, like, it feels weird because it feels so detached. And Mowgli may be a human, but, like, it doesn't feel like you're watching a thoroughly human character, does it? So
no.
Having him, like, show up, having him show up, it just feels strange.
Yeah, like he's been animalistic this entire time and then turns like, oh yes, this is human nature, that as soon as you see your own kind,
a girl, you can't do anything.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, all right. But it is followed up really well 38 years later in The Jungle Book 2. The Return of Shere Khan, which is a really great film. In fact, it has one really creepy scene involving Shere Khan and really wraps up the story well. What was your favourite set piece then? I know we've talked about the Bare Necessities a bit. What did you think of King Louis?
I was going to say, I really like the King Louis bit. I think it's got to go to Bare Necessities or the Elephants as my favourite set piece, because they're just so charming.
Yeah.
Bare necessities, mother nature's. Baloo's fantastic.
Yeah, I love Baloo as
he's
well.
He's so great. He's definitely one of my favourite Disney characters so far. He's so great.
There's only two or three songs in this, really, but they're also iconic. I forgot that there was lots of little scenes between them, and they flow quite nicely, actually. Like, you go straight from Bare Necessities, he gets kidnapped immediately, and you move straight on to I Want to Be Like You, and the dances and stuff. The bit where Baloo comes in, tries to overtake the monkeys, and then the passing back and forth of Mowgli is great fun as well. So this film doesn't really stop for like an hour. Like, the baby gets dropped off at the start, gets raised by the wolves, and then you go straight for him going around with Bagheera, straight to Kaa, straight to Bare Necessities, straight into I Want to Be Like You, and then Mowgli loses faith in Baloo and falls out with everyone, and then it slows down a little bit because you get Shere Khan, and it's just paced perfectly, I think, in this. He just comes in at the right time. You're like, ah, this is why Bagheera's from Yu-Gi-Oh! Bagheera wants Mowgli out because you meet Shere Khan at that moment. It's like, oh, yeah, you thought
I really
thought the snake
like
was dangerous? You thought
the
monkey
snake
was dangerous?
Yeah.
Have you seen the tiger?
I love him. You never know, because he's a snake, you never know if you can trust him the whole time.
Yeah. But yeah, the elephant's too cute. So,
very much one here to there.
It's not the last cute elephant you'll see. There's more coming. Anything Kingdom Hearts? I'm guessing not.
Not really. Jungle Book's pretty... There was a cancelled level that footage has been leaked from, but nothing in the official games.
So, we've reached the end of the Silver Age. Have a little review. So, what of the last eight films, then we'll put them all together. What was your favourite film of the Silver Age?
101 Dalmatians.
Huh. Okay, yeah, not one of the ones before. You've already said that, yeah. Why did it stand out above the others to you?
Mainly a matter of expectations. It just blew every expectation I had out of the window. Just great characters, great animation. Just everything Disney does well, but done really well.
Yeah. So my favourite film of this era was Lady and the Tramp. I went on about it quite a lot in our last episode. Just fell for the notion of getting a new pet. I was like, I've been through those emotions before. The excitement that the pet has, that the owner has, and the troubles you go through. The real sense of abandonment in that middle act, and then the sacrifice of the dog at the end, and it all comes together brilliantly. And the amount of time Tramp calls Lady a bitch was very funny.
Bitch.
Your least favorite film?
Sword in the Stone.
Yeah, Sword in the Stone. Yeah. See, I've got Cinderella under Sword of the Stone, just because I was a bit more disappointed with Cinderella, how boring it was. At least something happened there, I guess. But I was expecting a lot more from Cinderella, and I just didn't get what I was expecting.
The Silver Age has my favourite and least favourite films of Disney so far up to this point. Mm-hmm. It's all going to be topped when we get to the modern era. We get stuff like Tangled and Frozen 2, because the film's amazing. Wreck-It Ralph. But we're not there yet. But for now, it's a solid top of the list, I think.
And my next question, because we talked about the Golden Age, did it earn its title in a way? And you very firmed out, like, pointed out firmly that, yeah, it makes sense that these are the most well-renowned films. Like, this is what got Disney going. Do you think that these eight films were a success following the wartime? Like, do you get why... As this initial question that I said before, do you get why Disney is so massive and has such a grip on now, looking at these eight films that came out after the war? I mean, there are some absolute, like, massive names in this one, in this era.
I can see how this era turned Disney into household name, but what surprised me most about this era was that the ones that you hear massive things about, Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, they weren't the best ones. But the little ones that you don't... Because I don't really think you hear people talk about 101 Dalmatians or Lady and the Tramp that much, but they were really good.
And they were
like, but I can see how... And it, you see the full range throughout these eight films of what Disney can do, not just in terms of quality, but in terms of scale and storytelling and animation, character, it's all in here somewhere.
Yeah. All the best ones have animal main characters, so
that's a shame that Peter Pan turned out to be a horrible boy.
Yeah, well, he's the bad guy, isn't he? So and so that wraps up the Silver Age. 8 iconic films of varying qualities. They were the ones that I grew up watching the most on the VHS and DVD. I can say that for sure. Villains Hook and Cruella, heroes Mowgli and Tramp, all established in the history of cinema quite firmly. We now enter a pretty bleak period for Disney, without Walt Disney to guide them for the next 20 years or so. And so we get a lot of obscure films coming up next. But actually, this is the era of films I'm most excited to talk about. As I know for a fact, there are some here that Mike has, one, never seen, and most importantly, two, probably never even heard of. And I strongly believe that the Bronze Age includes some of the most ambitious and creative films Disney have ever produced. And some of the saddest, too. Goodbye, Mike.
Bye. Bye, everyone.